it would be a good idea to have an idea of where do these presuppositions come from in history. They're not just invented out of nothing.
That is Simply Focus with Every Channing and Dominic Gooder for live and joy and deep.
Are you ready for this new episode? Then please welcome your hosts, Elfie Cherney and Dominic Godad.
Welcome back to episode number 69 of the Simply Focus podcast.
We are in Bath after two wonderful days at the UKASFP conference 2019 and are excited to have Jonas Wells with us today. Hi, Jonas.
Hello, thank you so much for inviting me.
We are sitting here in the living room of Rob Black, one of the organizers of the UKASFP Conference 2019, together with Guy Shannon. And we have a beautiful view over Bath and the landscape, the hills here. And it's just great to be able to be here and, yeah, just enjoying the English way of living here together.
And we are very, very grateful that you, Jonas, decided last minute to join the conference and to have the opportunity to talk with you today here live and in person.
Yeah, well, I'm so extremely flattered to be asked to do the podcast. I'm an avid listener, so I love that. It would be difficult for me to find words that will be appropriate for this podcast, but I'll do my best. Yeah, it's an immense pleasure and honor to be able to be here with you.
Oh, thank you very much. It's also an honor for us. And you did a great webinar a few weeks ago about the history of solution focus and your timeline. I will come to that later on. You're an anthropologist. Mm-hmm. You're manager of a coordination agency in Sweden. You're a solution focus trainer. You're also getting into politics now, a politician. Yes. You're also an author, wrote a book about presuppositions in Swedish. You'll find that in the resource section and so much more.
And I am very inspired to write the book in English because many people have told me, I'm bilingual, by the way, so English and Swedish, they're both first languages for me. And it's nice to see that the Swedish version of the book is very appreciated and very helpful. So I'm very inspired to do that in English. So it will be coming out, but not in the next week or so, but hopefully later on this year or most probably beginning of next year.
We're looking forward to that. So Jonas, you're a solution-focused practitioner for many years and we are really curious to explore a little bit at the beginning. What fascinates you about solution focus?
Oh, what a surprising question. That's basically the only question I've been thinking about since you asked me to join the podcast. And the simplest way to answer that question is to reference Guy Shannon. We wrote an article together. He talked about it in his podcast recently that we picked a song and I picked a song called Keep Feeling Fascination by Human League, which we wrote about. And the song is a good answer to your question. What keeps me fascinated is that I'm keeping feeling fascinated. The fascination of solution focus is fascinating in itself. It doesn't stop. And actually, I just got the lyrics for the song here. The chorus is really funny. It says, keep feeling fascination, passion burning, love so strong. Keep feeling fascination, looking, learning, moving on. Isn't it amazing that for an approach that's deceptively so simple, we are still fascinated? What, 69 podcasts, we're still fascinated. Isn't that amazing? And it's not just my feeling of fascination, it's everybody else's. And we're still gathering, we're still talking, we're still writing, we're still exploring, and things are still emerging, which are new and fascinating. Isn't that cool?
And I'm fascinated a lot by your fascination around music as well. And a few years ago in Liverpool at a soul conference, I had the pleasure of joining a workshop with you and Guy where we talked about how to use music in training. And we are particularly excited to have you here because you're also the one who put together the solution-focused playlist, which is an amazing contribution, as I feel, to the field and collecting songs with lyrics that might have something to do with solution focus is great. So thank you very much for that. And maybe you can just share a little bit how this idea came up.
You know, something in me has always been important and the idea of utilization, you know, so how can I be most useful? How can I be of service to the people around me or my community around me in a way that is helpful and useful, and putting myself into situations where I do that because I feel better when I'm more useful. And I was thinking, so how can I contribute to the solution focused community? What is something I can be useful with? Well, I love music. You know, I'm not the only one. Lots of people love music. You know, when I'm not talking in a solutions focused manner, I might be listening to music. You know, I listen to lots of stuff. And I just got the idea of, would it be nice to do a playlist with solutions focused kind of songs? You know, so it's just like a reference to the Human League song, you know, passion burning. You know, okay, so what's my passion? Well, I'm passionate about music. Two passions of mine, solutions focused and music. And okay, I can be useful. Maybe there's something useful here. And very early on in that, I posted something, I think it was a Soul World list, asking for songs. I started with a few songs and, you know, always look at the bright side of life. And there's 725 songs at the moment, so there weren't that many songs to begin with. But anyway, very early on, I asked on a list, you know, are there more songs? And Guy was one of the first people who started, you know, there's plenty more songs. And he was very excited by the whole project. And lots of other people also sent me songs. I know Jenny Clark and people in Sweden. And so there's songs in all different types of languages and stuff. And it just grew and grew and grew. And I'm amazed. I mean, how can a song be solutions focused? I mean, we're appropriating songs. We're taking songs that were written in a completely different context and making them ours somehow. So when we listen to them now, they change somehow. So how could that really be useful? But people say it's useful. So if people say it's useful, then I got to take their word for it. So for instance, I hear stories of people saying, well, I play the music in my car when I go to work and I get reminded of scaling, or I get reminder of what's better because there's a song called What's Better. And people can pick songs, you know, if it's going to be useful in a workshop and want to start the workshop, I would go through the list. Oh, Pointer Sisters, I'm so excited, I could use that. You know, there's lots of really nice fun songs that could be used in any context really, and stuff. So it's kind of nice that people draw learning from music. And another thing I like to say is, my wife works with art and music and film, and I know in solutions focus we're way hooked on a language, but music is also a language, as well as art is also a language. They don't use words, it hasn't got the same grammar, but it's also communicating something. And music is so embodied. And if you listen to a good song, you can't stop tapping your feet or having a smile. And it's also social. You know, good music is something that we get into together, you know, and we play around.
We just experienced that at Alan Perry's concert he did right before the UK SFP conference. Yeah,
and I'm thinking, when we use the metaphor of language, the risk of it becoming very cerebral, is that the word, or cognitive, you know, very mind, classical mind idea that it's all stuck in your head and it has set rules and it's all like its own language game. But music has a different language game, and we can explore what solutions focus is through the experience of music. Isn't that fun? And I'm an anthropologist. I mean, we treat music as something secondary. It's something that we can add to the mix rather than something that we start with. But there are other cultures where music is primary form of expression in healing. It's something we drum our way through, or we dance our way into, you know, anxieties or, you know, troubles in life. I mean, every culture has ways of dealing with it. And some use music as the way of communicating what's better, you know, and getting to a stage of consciousness which is more helpful. So there's a lot of examples of that in anthropology, where music is just a different resource to get where you want to go.
This reminds me of some people on our podcast so far that have talked about similar aspects, like Mark Mitchell, for example, with the miracle question in a singing form, in a music form. And as anthropologists, you're very much also interested in history. And you had this great remark when we met a few days ago and said, well, doesn't everybody have this timeline? When I see or hear something, I just put it on a timeline and then I see how things emerge. And I was so stunned to hear that, because we don't have that. And when we saw that in your webinar and saw how you tell the story about the history of solution focus and what you're interested in, we were really stunned. So what led you on this journey, and what were your, or are your insights that you have gained from that so far?
From the history.
Yeah, from the history, and also the way of kind of putting it together.
I'm still learning, so it's not a finished journey anyway. But what started me are several things. One thing is, I mean, I have a lovely relationship with Harry Corman, and he's always talking about the history. He's always telling stories about Steve or Insu, or, you know, things that are going on in the history, and he takes history very seriously, that's for sure. And it's always so inspirational to hear him talking. So I kind of like in the milieu of, there is a lot of history, and I was always, I don't know all this history, and I'm thinking, can I really go into all of this history? It seems so daunting. So I've kind of like been putting it off for a long time, because, I mean, going through all the literature, all the Steve's books, I mean, do we really read all his books? I was thinking, I'm just a newbie to this. Everybody else has read his books. Everybody's got a timeline, and everybody's read the articles, all Death of Resistance, you know, and all that, and lots of other articles, or Milton Erickson. Everybody's a Milton Erickson expert, right? But they're not, I discovered. So what got me into it? What triggered me? You know, like, context matters. And for me, in my personal development, I've been a trainer for quite a long time, but I haven't really been designed designing training courses from A to Z. I mean, like going in, somebody else does the hard work and starts the course, and then I go in and do the fun stuff and supervise and help and just talk. And, you know, I'm into the whole idea of cultural change, so anybody can make a difference and we're all participating, and I'm here, I'm not going to go away, I'm not a consultant, I'm in the culture and in that way helping. But I took a decision a year ago that I'm going to do full trainings and design that in my way, and that has been something I've been thinking about for a really long time. How would I do it? What would be my first steps if I was to introduce solutions focus to in our training course? And I got inspired by Haesun Moon and Peter de Jong. They offered a free webinar course on the dialogic quadrant. I think you've mentioned it before in the podcast. If you listeners go into Haesun Moon, that was really inspiring. And Peter de Jong in that course says something on the side. He said, you know, it's really fascinating with the early period of solutions focus. I was like, is there a such thing as an early period contrasting to a later period? And it's somehow different. Wow, that's fascinating. I don't know anything about that. I want to learn. And then while I was starting to learn, I read Kirsten Dierolf has written an introduction. I think it's to a classic paper by David Kaiser on interaction a few years back. And in the introduction, she writes that going into the history is also a question of intellectual honesty. And that resonated very well with me. So I wanted to know, where did the ideas come from? And the third thing, as I'm writing the English version of the book on presuppositions, I thought it would be a good idea to have an idea, where did these presuppositions come from in history? They're not just invented out of nothing. They're produced in a context by certain people in a certain time in an environment that is conducive for that. And so just hearing that, was it Harleen Anderson, I think her name was, come up with the idea of not knowing. That's not Stephen Innes. It comes from somewhere else. There are people around, of course, and Eve Lipchick, and listen with a constructive ear. It's not just Stephen Innes. There are lots of other people who are influencing what we think is, you know, standpoints that we take very seriously when we do our work.
There are also people that we don't know that well anymore because there was not much written about them or by them, like Don Norum, for example, or others.
Yeah, somebody I discovered looking at the history, the character of Don Norum. I've never met him yet. I hope he's listening to this and, you know, hearing his name and having a little smile. It's amazing that he wrote a paper, I think some form of lecture or some form of seminar in the late 70s, The Family Has the Solutions, title of the paper. And he talks about what we later think of as pre-session change and how he asked people when they booked the meeting about things that were already going on that was useful. And I was like, wow. And how the story that this wasn't right at the time. It wasn't taken up. It was too bold. It was too radical, maybe. And then later on, people saying, maybe Steve was influenced by this. We don't know for sure, but maybe it was. It was out there, even though it wasn't really taken up as something that they referenced or used. And it's nice just to see that it's not just one person's genius. It's a collaborative effort. There are ideas coming. And even like the miracle questions coming up, well, the significance of the miracle question changes due to the context. In the beginning, it's just a question among lots of other questions, but 5 years later, it's a question that is the question. It's not just the ideas are free from time. They're set in context, set in time, socially and culturally.
So history is changing.
History is changing. And the way we talk about history is changing. And that was something also that really surprised me when I did the webinar. I was thinking, people were signing up for this webinar, and it was like people that I really look up to. I'm thinking, I'm just, even though I've been doing this for several years, they're so qualified. I mean, they can't be anything that I'm saying that they don't already know. This is like ABC stuff for them. And then getting the feedback, wow, it was such a nice package, or you were talking about this in a very specific way that was illuminating or something inspiring. Wow, isn't that amazing? And also that they were being reminded, or their interest was coming back, or there was something that they were learning from the experience. And I found that, wow, how history is very much something we do now, and it's something that is projecting forward into the future. And what I'm really learning is the significance of the early period that Peter de Jong was talking about, that stretches from 78 roughly to 84 85, I don't know, something like that, where they don't have a set model, they don't have the language that we have today, the solution focused approach, the solution focused model. It's much more explorative and collective and experiential and a bit crazy because they're just trying out anything. It would be lovely to see a paper or story written about, so what are the preconditions for that creativity? Is this something that we could learn from? You know, we do know the approach now, we do know the model, but what if we pretended that there wasn't a model, and when we train our people who want to learn solutions focus, could we invite them into a space that is much more open and creative, and let's explore rather than like they explored, and, you know, make it more fun in that way, and that so that they're building on what they're naturally already interested in, rather than me coming and saying, here's a model, do the model. And another thing with the model, I had a great conversation with Svea van der Horn a week or two back. She doesn't know this. I was transcribing our conversation because there's some nice things in there. We're talking about the model, but when we say it in a South African dialect, it sounds like the muddle, model and muddle. So I was like, that's interesting. So could we refrain from the muddle and start talking about, you know, or just be more open and experiential and interactive when we work rather than presenting, I know something that you need to know. It sometimes didn't rhyme with me anyway. So I'm exploring still.
That was also one thing that fascinated us when we heard stories of people that were at BFTC around that time. They were all so excited about this vibrant atmosphere of learning and trying out. And Scott Miller, for example, had the term in our podcast of solution focus. Back then was a verb and not a noun.
Yeah,
and somehow it became a noun when, of course, people started to describe what the model is, what solution focus is. And a lot of people putting in a lot of effort to also kind of go back in time again to really foster that learning atmosphere.
Yeah.
And of course, after almost 40 years of practice, we know a lot of things out of practice, and solution focus works, and all the things that emerge in the meantime work really, really well. And still the question, how can we be open and kind of have this vibrant learning atmosphere and learn even more? And that's one question that also is very fascinating for us too. Also, when we go back to the history, you told us a story that also the history changed in the writings of Steve, and that they write differently about pastime and later periods.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there's several versions of how the miracle question emerged, for instance. There are probably more than these three, but this is just my understanding. One of them is the connection to Milton Erickson. There's nothing new. It's connected to the crystal ball or the magic wand. And these are things that Steve published and wrote about, 77 or 78. There's an article about that. So techniques from Milton Erickson. It's nothing new in that case. You know, imagine something that's different in the future and how would that look like? And so that concept is already there. So that's one story. And the other story is Insu discovered it from a client, you know, the unnamed anonymous heroes of our development, the clients that taught us how to work. And the client says, you know, that would take a miracle. And Insu responding, oh, a miracle. So suppose a miracle happened. And from there. And I placed that, I have a reference somewhere placing that in time, somewhere in 82, something like that. There's no way of knowing exactly that that happened, but a reference says 82. And then there's a story of Jim Wilkes, and it's in Malinan's paper. And he starts working there 84, 85. And he sees, I think it's Steve using a miracle type question. And he's in the observation room and he has a conversation with Steve afterwards and said, you know, that question is significantly different from all our other questions. It's worth something worth exploring. And Steve goes, maybe you're onto something. Maybe we should explore this question a little bit more. And the next day he uses the question and people in the observation room are asked, I think, to note all the useful answers. How many useful answers? And they were astounded that there were so many useful answers to the question and something that was worth exploring. And then they have a conversation again, Steve and Jim. And Jim says, you know, this is something, we're not talking about problems now, we're talking about solutions. And Steve says, yeah, this is solutions therapy or something. I think I'm right in getting it right. But Jim could correct me. Really nice to hear that story again. There's a quite an elaborate story in Malinan's paper on the history of solutions focus. And I think the story comes from Elam Nunnally because I think that's his primary source. But it's fascinating. All three could be right. It's not a question of what's right and wrong, what's more believable, but there's a lot of detail in Jim Wilkes's story, so that makes it strange that that would be made up. So I think there's definitely a case that all those three things happened somehow, but the significance of those things changes over time.
There's also a story that Frank Thomas told us when we asked him what would we see or notice when we could see all the archive of the SFBTA. And he told us about those moments of foreshadowing.
Yeah.
Kind of Steve sitting on the ground and reflecting in a team meeting and then saying, I wonder what if the problem wasn't here. And kind of this moment of where you could see, oh, there's something happening, and foreshadowing of the miracle question.
I think there's a lot of that. Donorum is definitely a foreshadowing somehow. But it's interesting, the ideas aren't developed out of context. Context matters. How we frame it, or what people are around us, or how we feel relaxed in it, or creative enough to try it out again, or if there's politics involved or not, that matters, you know, how ideas emerge. Maybe that matters more than just the idea and the intellectual property of the idea. It seems so, such a construct somehow. So it's interesting to talk about, you know, the conditions or the culture of the emergence of new ideas, not just the new idea itself, because as, you know, even now we're talking, I suppose for our listeners too, it'll change. The history changes, and what we now think is important or different or interesting has changed, and maybe changes the way we take a step tomorrow. Yeah.
And for all those who want to learn more about the rumors of solution-focused history, please go and re-listen to Jonah's webinar. It was hosted by the SFIO, and you will find the link to the audio recording in our podcast, as well as a link to the
timeline. Yes, I haven't published the timeline because it's still like a work in progress. It'll probably always be a work in progress. The story of the timeline is that it was something that would aid me to I was going through all this material, and they all had the different versions of the history. When they came up with a date or, you know, a time, I put it in just for my own sense of, you know, structure. And I had the idea that everybody's got a timeline somewhere, and they've got to have some version. And the easiest version is we know which years Steve wrote his books. You know, they were published 82 85, you know, 88 92, you know, 94. So you have some timeline kind of stuff. But as I wanted to go into more of the details, you know, when did things happen and stuff, so I made a timeline. Yes, it's a work in progress, and I want to get it out there. There's nothing I want to keep on my own, because I get the sense that it's useful. I'm gladly have it published on your webpage as a kind of a rough first draft, and I'd like to be able to create the opportunity to get more feedback, because there's tons of people out there who know so much more, who have things to contribute and question that would be useful. Like the Solutions Focus playlist, we could develop it together and do it more collectively and build on it somehow.
So you will certainly find contact details to Jonas as well in the resource section of this podcast, and you can also comment in the comment field, of course, and Jonas will be there as well.
Yeah, love that.
So how could this timeline or this view on history be useful, be supportive for practitioners now for their own practice?
I had a really interesting discussion with Guy about this morning, just on that, because as he grew up through Brief, they don't go through the history. The question is it necessary to know the history of Solutions Focus to be able to practice it? And I think they kind of landed in, no, it's not really necessary. We can still do the work without knowing where these ideas come from. And he was like being a little bit the devil's advocate, you know, do we really need it? Yes and no. For me, it was a conscious decision going into the role of trainer even more, taking that role very seriously and writing a book. And he came up with this similar story that he researched the history when he was reading his book. So it is a case of intellectual honesty, you know, knowing where the ideas come from. It does matter where things come from. I do feel at the conference yesterday, for instance, when Anne Rambo was talking about taking a position on working in a wider context with systems, inside, outside systems, and I kind of got the idea, well, that doesn't rhyme with Steve's ecosystemic idea of we're already part of the system, so how can we talk about as if we're not? We wouldn't talk about our clients in a way that, so if we came in with a client, we would be talking about, I'm trying to get in your head. We'd be saying, no, we're interacting, so aren't we interacting with the systems already? And then referencing death of resistance and the ecosystemic, maybe we're going towards a macrosystemic way of working now, that the more people or more things that we should be mindful of when we do the work, maybe that is influencing. Then a guy said yesterday that he was very inspired by the question of, what if we asked, what are our best hopes instead of your best hopes, because we're already connected? Or what do we want from this conference rather than what do I want from this conference, because we're already a collective in the room? How would we notice this conference pleasured us and sent us in a direction that we like? So the we-ness and the ourness. And somebody noted on the manifesto, which I haven't been involved into creating, but I'm really supportive of, is the idea of the world. Isn't it more correct with our world? It's nothing outside of us. We're already in it. So we already have a relationship to it, as kind of symptoms of a change of frame, a change of mindset, that we're not just working with a family system or the therapist and family system. We're actually working with the therapist, family system, and a wider context, the social context. It's strange for me to ignore that. It doesn't make sense. And seeing that with an historical perspective, seeing that these are the basic idea of solutions focus, that we could draw that in. There's a history here that we can make use of to create depth and a different perspective on the work we do. I found it really nice to be able to very assuredly reference Death of Resistance or Patterns, which is like a book we don't talk about that much today, but it's really significant and it's still radical. And it's so nice with this SF World Day as well, that 3rd of May isn't a random day. It's a day where Death of Resistance, the article, was published. It was accepted to be published. And I remember in this SF World Day, we were talking about Death of Resistance, and Arnold Huber's published a short video of Insu talking about Death of Resistance. I think I wrote a post on the Facebook page about, you know, where's this idea coming from, which is basically just stealing Harry Corman's story. And I know there was a group in Singapore around Debbie and Dave Hogan. They were talking about, had a kind of like a workshop around the idea of Death of Resistance. And so bringing history back in, because it's still significant. Why did Harry suggest the 3rd of May as the day for SF World Day. Well, it's one of the one or two or three most radical ideas of solutions focus that's still radical, the idea of resistance, and instead replacing it with cooperating. So what is the client cooperating with us? How is the client cooperating with us and being in line with that? So for instance, yesterday we were talking about more collaborative solutions focused practice. How would that look like? Or collective approach, how would that look like? Would it would make sense that we would be collaborating with the system rather than fighting the system? So if you go to other manifestos, like political manifestos from political parties, they'll be, we are fighting this. This is our opponent. We want liberalism, or we want conservatism, or we want socialism. And there'll be a set of struggles that we want to fight for, which we can still fight for. But if we're doing it in a solutions-focused way, we would be collaborating, rather. We'd be finding ways to position ourselves where we could make a difference. You know, the idea of utilization. How can we be more useful? If there are people misunderstanding things, how can we be on the lookout for what's useful in the misunderstandings? Because that's something that we can contribute with, and hopefully bring people together and do something that's more useful and effective. So I don't know if that was a good way of answering your question about how history is relevant, but I think history, for me at least, is giving me a lot of inspiration. So why not?
We sometimes compare it with the development of a telephone, and of course now if you have a smartphone, you don't need to know how older telephones worked anymore. However, if you know that, or if you even were part of that, you have a huge appreciation for the development. And kind of when you see an old telephone, I look at it and think, oh, this is nice. This is something relevant that has happened on this path, because it gives a huge appreciation. And maybe it also connects to the idea of that's really simple to use solution-focused question and conversation. For that, you don't need to know the history.
No, you don't.
Now, at the UK SFP conference, we talked about collectivizing solution focus, and also for, let's say, the last few years, many people talked about and did a lot of things like our tour, for example, or other things, but bringing solution focus more into everyday life. And what I see is that people who are aware of the history and aware of also the context of when it happened and what happened, that they are much more able to adopt those ideas to now new contexts, like collectivizing ideas or everyday life, kind of taking it out of the therapy room into the community. And it's still very easy to ask solution focus question, but what we're doing now is something similar than what you do with your training courses. Kind of simple to just go in and training course and teach them a few questions. But then as soon as you want to create a whole course or a whole new idea and dimension of how solution focus can be used, I think it's very relevant to know at least some of the most important aspects and developments of the history of solution focus.
I don't give them the history the first thing they do when they get into the room. I can make that clear, that it's not a history lecture that the first thing they meet. I'm very into much the experiential side of learning, and actually trying to take as little part of their learning process as possible and let them do the learning. But I was surprised when I did the lecture. I did it first on 3rd of May in my local environment. People found it so useful to get some form of structure about where these ideas come from and how they emerged and in what context, what brought it on. And so why is social constructionism important for solution focus? I hear some people say, we don't need to know about social construction. Why read Wittgenstein? It's too complicated. Greg Bateson, even Steve had trouble reading Bateson. He's so abstract. But still, I think it does make a difference if we can make the effort. And there are texts out there that make things easier. You know, the idea of the difference that makes a difference, or how things are socially constructed, makes it easier for us to live, I think, sometimes. We don't have to be in argument with everything. We still need to fight social injustice. Yes, we must. I think so. I think that's a moral, ethical stance. And that's something I maybe would like to say something in this podcast, that our ideas are political, our ideas are ethically challenging, and it's difficult to do solutions focus as a way of life, because yes, you have to somehow make your own voice. You can't be as vociferous, or you know, you can't be expressive as much as you'd like to be. You have to be able to more listen, you'd be able to be more responsive. It's a little bit like the Zen master bit. You can't go out telling everybody the truth. You've got to actually coach people into situations which are more fruitful and useful. And that's difficult. That's really hard. You know, it's like going against your human humanity in a way. You want to be able to be more helpful. You want to be more direct. But we, in solutions, we're very indirect. We don't go for the obvious thing. I'm going to tell you what to do. That's the obvious thing. We don't do that. We have to refrain ourselves and say, okay, I'm going to wait. I'm going to wait until it comes. And that's not always easy. Or seldom, rarely easy. I mean, it's still difficult, at least for me. I love to talk. So challenge of the week for me is to be silent. But I do want to say something about that, that our position is ethical. And that's why I'm in a position of not being, I haven't taken the choice of being a consultant yet, you know, open, you know, being on the outside, looking in to companies or organizations and stuff. I take a position being within the system, working with the organizations long-term in my local environment. It's also the reason why I'm going into politics, because I think there's a lot of people who could benefit from our way of thinking and talking, and maybe they'd find me useful. And so for me, the Labour Party or the Social Democratic Party of Sweden was somewhere I wanted to explore. It wasn't the first party I went to. The first party I went to was a feminist party, but they were so small in my range that there was nobody there. So there was no social collective I could engage with. But the Social Democratic Party, they are a lovely bunch of people who really want to make a difference to the world. And I really respect, the politicians get a lot of crap from people, but they really are investing a lot of their free time only on the premise that they'd like to make the world a better place. I'm not talking about the power people who love power, because sometimes that comes into play, because if you really want to change the system or make a difference, you have to have some power. But all the local politicians who go to all these meetings, who read all the stuff, the tiresome work of going through documents after documents and talking and having meetings and, you know, internally in the party and with other organizations, trying to figure out with the constituents, people who are living there. There's a lot of discussions there, but could solutions focus make a difference? Could we be listening for what's useful and more interactive with our environment rather than following a party program? I think our ethics matter. For me, my ethics was very much in line with every person's a resource. For me, that was an easy choice to make, go a little bit more to the left. I could have easily gone to the right, you know, liberalism, yeah, that's the same idea there, that every person's a resource. So I wouldn't knock any other party, but I think we can make a difference in the world. And we're not that many of us, really. I mean, in the big scheme of things, but we know that something very little can make a big difference. And if we are that little thing in a position where somebody gets a moment and say, "Ooh, maybe I should ask what you'd like to see instead," rather than just complaining about the roads or hospitals. And so how, what would instead look like? Could we collaborate with that? Would that be something interesting? Yes, I'd like to do that. Right, so now we have an interesting idea to work with. And talking with a politician or with people in your social environment and trying to move towards a more responsible, ethical development, you know, we can all do that. And we all do it already. We all do it already in our different ways. So it's a question of being more conscious about it and making some choices.
Deliberate choices.
Deliberate
ideally.
Choices. Yes.
Thank you very much, Jonas. I love the way how you highlight usefulness, how you highlight ethics, how you highlight the importance of listening to each other, and how you highlight that we constantly mutually influence each other and that we build on each other, and that an idea is nothing that comes from one place and one person, but that we co-create together, and that's something we constantly do. And
yes,
bringing this to a global level is something that's very inspiring to me as well. Looking back on your solution-focused journey over the years, if there's one thing you would love to highlight now, because it was a very important learning for you, it made a huge difference for you, what is it that comes to your mind right now?
Wow, what a nice question. What comes to mind? Very easy. 2004, Björn Johansson asked me to come to Seoul in Stockholm and do a presentation. We've been doing extraordinary work in our part of Sweden where 16 different organizations were working together, learning solutions focus and practicing, and 16 organizations for a whole year. It was a massive course and supervision, you know, led to lots of good things that are still going on, really evolved. So Björn said, come to Stockholm. And I went to Stockholm, and it was such an amazing experience to just get in contact with this lovely community that we are part of, that your podcast is sharing. I mean, us Europeans, we had no idea that there were so many lovely people in the States. You're really making it so clear for us. Oh yeah, I sensed it, of course, but the stories weren't there. Anyway, so at that conference, I was so inspired. There were so many lovely things going. All the people I was meeting was so illuminated. I was like, wow, this is my tribe. Yeah, this is, I want to be part of this. This is something I like. And I remember the open space on the last day, and I have a background in research, and I thought, I want to do research in solutions focus. So I went up on stage, open space. And in my group, I didn't know who these people were. There was Harry Corman, Gail Miller, and, you know, Ben Furman, and all these like, great. So being very, you know, supportive, and I was like, wow. And I didn't know who they were. It was afterwards, it dawned on me, they were there. So my message with this is, you know, the solutions focused community is a massive resource for people who are interested in this way of working. So go to a conference, you know, get people together and talk about the work you do, start creating spaces for reflection and learning. It's such a rich network of people. It's so rich, really, and it does make a huge difference just reaching out. We're so inclusive, we love people, we love different people. Nice nice thing about the conference yesterday, that somebody at the end is saying, I'm an artist. All of you people are doing solutions work. I'm just an artist. We're like, whoa, you're an artist. Your perspective on what we're doing is so different. Tell us what you're learning. What are you seeing that we don't see? It's amazing. So directly we are like, you're not the lowest. You're on the top. You know, this is something that we really like. And then people say that. They always say that when they come to our conferences, no matter how they're organized. You know, it doesn't have to be a certain style. They'll say, wow, what a great bunch of people. It's so nice. So I really like to forward that every time I meet with other practitioners, it's a joy. I'm alive in an extra way, you know, even more. It's something that really gives me energy.
Thank you very much for this sharing. And you talked earlier about the challenge of the week for yourself. Oh. So we would also love to invite you to invite our audience to a challenge of the week.
Yeah, I think I'm going to give myself a challenge for the week, if that's okay. I'm still learning. There's a lot to be learnt. And I wonder if I'm going to steal something that I picked up from Mark Gardiner just a couple of days ago. And if Mark Gardiner, you should look him up, Zebra Collective in Plymouth, they're doing amazing work. And they're really taking the step of going into social change and social injustice and making the world a better place. And he started his workshop with really nice, with introducing the idea of both being reflective and reflexive. And the reflexive bit is, you know, taking yourself very seriously and asking yourself some hard questions. So maybe the challenge of the week should be that hard. So I'd like to invite your listeners and myself primarily, this is definitely a message to me first, is take some time, you know, go for a walk, sit down or find some space and time for yourself in the coming week and ask yourself 5 questions. What am I doing? Why am I doing it? How am I doing at it? How am I doing in it? And what am I bringing to it? That could be something worth exploring. Just to position yourself in the best possible way, anybody can make a contribution to social change and injustice in their environment. How are you doing? You know, how am I doing? And what am I bringing to it? So we'll put those questions in the challenge on the week, won't we?
Yes. We certainly do. So a big shout out and a big thank you to Mark and a big thank you to you for sharing Mark's questions with us. And I'm looking forward to do this challenge of the week and to take some time, maybe even together with Dominic, to discuss it afterwards.
Yeah, we'll do that. And please let us know what you experienced, what was useful while doing the challenge. Also, let us know what was useful for you in this podcast. And of course, as usual, you'll find as many resources as possible. We mentioned so many resources. We'll put all the things that we can in the resource section of the podcast. So go to www.sfontour.com/simplyfocuspodcast and then go to episode number 69.
69. Right. Thank you so much for letting me express myself and be with you. It's so nice to be with you. So we'll be talking all day today. I'm so happy to be able to be with you. So lovely.
Thank you very much, Jonas, for being with us.
And for me, this podcast was also a tribute to so many people who contributed to Solution Focus, to where we are now. And also a name mentioned that really touched me at my first Soul Conference. And it's also a tribute to Björn Johansson. So thank you very much, Björn, for taking...
Oh, wow. I owe him everything. Him and Eva Persson.
Yes, him, yeah, and Eva, yeah. So thank you very much, you two, for bringing Jonas to Stockholm to the Soulwork Conference.
I'm hopefully smiling somewhere up in heaven. Oh, wow. Oh, I just love thinking about Björn. What a man. Do you know what he usually did? When he introduced his workshops, he would start with saying something about the world, you know, making the world a better place. And he would always have pamphlets or brochures of certain charities that he'd like to just endorse. So if anybody wanted to do that. So he took that stance of, you know, taking global responsibility. He was doing it already 10 years ago.
So he's still whispering in our ears.
Yes. Wow, what a man.
Thank you very much also for this story. And yeah, I'm looking forward to being here next week again.
So thank you and goodbye.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
I have tears in my eyes.
Yeah.
Nice to bring in Björn. That was nice. Thank you for that.
You're listening to the Simply Focus podcast with Alfie Czerny and Dominic Godat, your podcast for a life in joy and ease.